Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. And as a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you, Mary, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's workshop. This is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and the Lymphoma Research Foundation, and we're delighted to have so many of you on the call today. And this is a collaborative effort also with a number of other cancer organizations, and it really is because of that collaborative effort that we've been able to reach so many of you on the call today. We have over 360 participants on the call today, and you come from all over the United States. And all different regions. And we also have international participants from Canada, Morocco, Syria, Nigeria, and the United Kingdom. So you really come from all over the world. It really is a credit to each of you that you're choosing to spend the next hour with us. The topic of today's program is update on Hodgkin lymphoma, which is a topic that's so important for us to cover today. Now, I'd like to turn your attention for a moment to the materials that you received from Cancer Care. In those materials is information about our speakers, the topics they'll be covering, and there also is information about all the different collaborating organizations as a resource for you. There is, and indeed, an evaluation form as well, and we would ask you to complete that evaluation form at the end of the program. Your feedback is really so critically important to us as we plan programs during this year. And I have to say, and moving into, of course, 2012, and this topic was one that many of you asked us to offer, and we take your recommendations very seriously. So tell us what you want, and we'll try very hard to offer those programs for you. This program was supported through a grant to the Lymphoma Research Foundation from Seattle Genetics, and I really want to thank them for their support of today's program. This is so important to have this support. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today, and I want to start by introducing our first speaker, Dr. David Strauss. Dr. Strauss is attending physician, Lymphoma Service, Department of Medicine, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. And Dr. Strauss is going to address biology of Hodgkin lymphoma, treatment options for newly diagnosed patients, how clinical trials contribute to treatment options, and communicating with your healthcare team. It's my pleasure to turn the program over to Dr. Strauss.
Good afternoon. We're going to discuss Hodgkin lymphoma today. This is one of the types of malignant lymphoma. Malignant lymphomas are cancers of the lymphatic system, a system made up of white blood cells called lymphocytes. Diagnosis of this cancer, like most other cancers, is made by looking at a piece of the tumor under the microscope. There are two big categories of malignant lymphoma. There are non-Hodgkin lymphomas, which are very much more common, and then less common are Hodgkin lymphomas. We'll be discussing the latter today. Hodgkin lymphoma comes in two variants also. There's classical Hodgkin lymphoma, which is the majority of cases, and then there is a small subgroup, which is called lymphocyte-predominant Hodgkin lymphoma, which is only maybe 3 to 5% of the cases. This disease is in some ways similar to some of the slow-growing non-Hodgkin lymphomas. If we have time, we can talk about its management. The classical Hodgkin lymphoma, the most common type, is nodular sclerosis, in which you see a lot of scar tissue mixed in with the Hodgkin lymphoma under the microscope. This is about 60 to 80% of cases in North America and Western Europe. Typically, a typical patient would be a young female. Enlargement of lymph nodes in the chest or the mediastinum is very common. Mixed cellularity type is the second most common. It is seen more in the developing world and is more typical in older patients, may not have involvement of the chest, and then the most rare type is one called lymphocyte depletion, which is rarely diagnosed, sometimes diagnosed in the HIV setting. We have a staging system for Hodgkin lymphoma, which we've been using for approximately 40 years. And this staging system divides the body in half by the diaphragm, which is the muscle that divides the chest cavity from the abdominal cavity. There are four stages. Stage one would be disease just in one lymph node area. Stage two would be disease in two or more lymph node areas, either above or below the diaphragm. Stage three would be disease in lymph nodes and or spleen. Spleen's considered to be a lymph node in this staging, though it is not exactly, but disease in lymph nodes or spleen and or spleen on both sides of the diaphragm, above and below, for example, groin and nodes and neck nodes. And stage four is disease in lymph nodes plus a site that is not a lymph node, so-called extranodal site. In the case of Hodgkin lymphoma, this is usually bone or bone marrow, liver, or lung. Within each stage, you can have no symptoms or you can have symptoms. Hodgkin lymphoma is unusual in that it produces things that can cause indirect symptoms. So no symptoms would be A. Symptoms associated with prognosis are B, and these are fevers, night sweats, drenching night sweats causing you to awaken and change your pajamas or nightgown, and weight loss. So you can be 1A, 2A, 3A, 4A with no symptoms, or 1B, 2B, 3B, 4B. We also have an X subtype for very large disease, particularly in the chest. And we usually work up patients with a history and physical exam, attention to the sites where lymph nodes can be enlarged and to symptoms. We have certain blood tests that we look at. And then there are imaging studies. We use CAT scans of the chest, abdomen, and pelvis, which is a kind of computerized X-ray that can show us the size of lymph nodes, liver, and spleen. And we use PET scanning, which is a nuclear medicine test that takes advantage of the observation that cancer cells tend to take up sugars faster than normal cells. So we use a radioactively labeled sugar, inject it, and then do a nuclear medicine scan. And we sometimes also do bone marrow biopsies, particularly in patients with a lot of disease. This is a disease where we have had great success for really over 30 years, with cures in 70 to 90-plus percent of patients, depending on the stage. The challenge has been since most people are surviving, is to try to tailor treatment to both to improve results for the group of patients who do not do as well, who are not cured, and also to try to reduce the late toxicity in and side effects of treatment in patients who are long-term survivors. So I guess I'll sort of divide this into early stage, which would be stage 1 and 2, and advanced stage, which would be stage 3 and 4. So for early stage Hodgkin lymphoma, radiation therapy for 40 years was kind of the cornerstone of treatment, and was probably the first treatment that really resulted in a high percentage of cures. It's been found that chemotherapy and radiation therapy gives a better result with respect to relapses than radiation therapy alone. And because a lot of the late toxicities are associated with radiation therapy, over the last several decades, the size and amount of radiation therapy has been reduced in combination with chemotherapy. And in more recent years, we have been looking at chemotherapy alone without radiation therapy in most patients. So the standard chemotherapy regimen that's used in most programs and for both, at least in North America, is a regimen called ABVD, which is doxorubicin or adriamycin, bleomycin or vinblastin, and dacarbazine. This is usually given for 4 to 6 treatments. It's been shown in early stage 1 and 2 disease without radiation therapy to give a good result. Adding radiation therapy may reduce the early relapse, a number of early relapses by maybe up to 5%. Although we do have very effective treatment for minority of patients who do relapse, and Dr. Shustoff will discuss this. The argument is that you really can save most people from more toxic treatments. So this has been addressed in a few randomized trials, one from Canada that was conducted in Canada and by the Eastern Cooperative Oncology Group. I believe the long-term results will be reported this year at the American Society of Hematology next month. For advanced stages, we have relied on chemotherapy, and combination chemotherapy was the second big advance in curing Hodgkin lymphoma in the more advanced stages, stages 3 and 4. The regimen that was introduced 40 years ago was the MOPP or MOP regimen, which was nitrogen mustard, vincristine, procarbazine, prednisone. ABVD has really supplanted that regimen in this country because it's been shown to give possibly a little bit better response rate, but also less toxicity. In Europe, there is a more intensive regimen called dose-escalated BACOP, which is bleomycin, etoposide, doxorubicin, cyclophosphamide, vincristine, procarbazine, and prednisone. This is widely used in Europe, particularly in Germany, and does have a higher response rate and possibly even better survival, but is associated with substantially higher toxicity. So the question is whether everybody needs to get this with advanced stage disease or whether you can use ABVD. Radiation therapy in advanced stage disease has really been pretty much abandoned, is not being used much because it's been shown in good randomized studies that if you give adequate combination chemotherapy like ABVD or something equivalent to it and you get a complete remission, adding radiation therapy does not improve things and may add to toxicity. So this brings me to clinical trials. In North America and in Europe, there are similar trials. In North America, there are three national studies that are attempting to kind of tailor treatment for patients according to how they do during treatment using a biomarker of PET scanning. And it's been shown that PET scan at the end of treatment, if it is negative, there's a low risk of relapse. If it's positive, there's a higher risk of relapse, although there are false positives. And the same thing has been shown with PET scanning during treatment, say after two cycles of ABVD. So all three of these trials have a similar design. So for early stage disease where there are not bulky masses, the trial is using ABVD, chemotherapy for two cycles, a PET scan. Patients who are PET negative go on to, which we anticipate will be about 85% of patients, will go on to just get two more cycles of ABVD and then stop. Patients who are PET positive, who may be at a higher risk of recurring, get more intensive treatment, chemotherapy with the escalated BACOP regimen and radiation therapy. For early stage patients, 1 and 2 have bulky disease, particularly in the chest, in the mediastinum, this area in the center of the chest. The design is simpler. Two cycles of ABVD, PET scan, PET negative, four more cycles of ABVD, a total of six, and then stop. PET positive, four cycles of more intensive chemotherapy, escalated BACOP, and radiation therapy. And then for the advanced stages, stages 3 and 4, 2 ABVD, PET scan, PET negative, four more cycles of ABVD. This should be about 75% of patients, 25% may be PET positive, and they'll get six more cycles of the more intensive escalated BACOP chemotherapy. So we are trying in clinical trials to tailor treatment and to give less treatment and less toxic treatment to the majority of patients where that's adequate, and then zero in with more intensive treatment on the patients who might need it. And these trials are using PET scan as a tool to do this. So I think there's a definite advantage to patients enrolling in these studies, which are open in many places throughout the country.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Strauss, for an excellent and informative presentation, very informative, and I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Andrei Shustov. Dr. Shustov is Assistant Professor of Medicine, Division of Hematology, University of Washington School of Medicine, Research Associate, Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center. And Dr. Shustov is going to address treatment options for patients with relapsed refractory disease, the role of clinical trials, managing treatment side effects, and quality of life concerns. It's my pleasure to turn the program over to Dr. Shustov.
Thank you, and good afternoon, everybody who is listening. It is my absolute pleasure to participate in today's call. I do see a lot of Hodgkin lymphoma patients in my practice, and we're doing a lot of clinical studies in this disease, and I am delighted to share our experience and to speak out my opinion and bring you up to state-of-the-art management of the Hodgkin lymphoma that now has relapsed after initial attempts of cure. The first message, the take-home message that I would like to give patients and families who are listening, that if Hodgkin lymphoma relapses after initial therapy, and this certainly is expected to happen in a small minority of patients, we still are hoping to cure the disease for good. So disease is still potentially curable. This is not the situation where we start talking about just palliative or quality of life issues. We try to go for the cure. So how do we set our sail and try to cure Hodgkin lymphoma that came back? The standard of care in the United States, Canada, and developed countries in Europe for relapsed Hodgkin lymphoma is a procedure called autologous stem cell transplant or autologous bone marrow transplant. And for those who are listening, to avoid any confusion, for all practical purposes, stem cell transplant and bone marrow transplant are absolutely interchangeable terms. And nowadays, stem cell transplant is used more. In the past, bone marrow transplant was referred to more frequently. So what does stem cell transplant consist of? If lymphoma comes back after initial therapy, what we know about Hodgkin lymphoma in particular, that in majority of patients, or maybe roughly half of the patient, it still remains sensitive to chemotherapy. And the reason it did not get cured first time around, that the doses of chemotherapy were not just enough to kill off every single lymphoma cell. So the idea of autologous transplant is to give the patient very high doses of chemotherapy that otherwise we would not subject people up front, because majority get cured, and hopefully eliminate every Hodgkin cell in the body and then salvage the patient with this procedure. High-dose chemotherapy, besides killing the tumor cells, obviously has much more significant side effects. And the reason this has to be done exactly in the setting that I am describing to you is that the main organ that's subjected to high-dose treatment is the bone marrow. So after you give high-dose chemotherapy, in the majority of people, the bone marrow will have very hard time coming back, recovering, and some patients will not recover ever. That's why the high-dose treatment is requires to give salvage with your own stem cells, with your own bone marrow, and that's what autologous term means. It's your own bone marrow collected prior to high-dose treatment. So how is it done? If your disease is detected to relapse after initial therapy, what your physicians will be talking to you about is first step that is called salvage treatment. What salvage treatment means that before the autologous transplant, we still need to put disease back in remission, meaning reduce the number of tumors, reduce the number of tumor cells to the point where we can almost cannot see them on the PET scans and CT scans. This is typically done with more intensified protocols than ABVD, and the most frequently ones used in this country are regimen called ICE, ICE, or DHAP, DHAP, and those letters stand for chemotherapy names. So patients typically receive 2-3 cycles of this chemotherapy spaced out 2 to 3 weeks apart, and immediately after that, patients undergo procedure called pheresis, or very similar to what you would see in kidney dialysis pictures. So you sit in a chair and your blood runs through the machine and machine separates your stem cells from your blood. After collecting your stem cells, those are washed and frozen. And a couple of weeks later, patients typically receive 3 or 4 chemotherapy drugs infused by vein at very high doses. And immediately after the last infusion, your stem cells or your bone marrow cells are thawed up and infused back into your vein. And even though your bone marrow gets damaged by chemotherapy, your frozen stem cells rush right in, go into your bones, start growing, and start producing your blood system again. And 2-3 weeks after high-dose therapy, people typically have nearly normal blood counts, and the acute phase of the treatment is over. The whole idea of this procedure is that very high doses of treatment will eliminate all the tumor cells. And by doing this procedure, we still cure a significant number of patients whose Hodgkin lymphoma came back. Now, I'll mention here that the side effects of the salvage treatments and the bone marrow transplant itself significantly higher than ABVD, but this is the price that we have to pay to still try and cure the lymphoma. A lot of patients might have fevers and infections because obviously chemo treatment will lower the immune system. A lot of patients can have significant inflammation of the intestinal tract and mouth with diarrhea and mouth pain. A lot of patients will have significant fatigue, and there are some other side effects that are very specific to chemo regimens. Obviously, fatigue is very common. So after the transplant is completed, the sequence of salvage treatment, stem cell collection, high-dose therapy, reinfusion of stem cells, we observe the patients. And again, significant number of patients, disease does not come back. For the sake of time, I will jump right into the next step. What happens if your disease relapsed after autologous transplant? Now, this is a big challenge. And that's where you sit down and have very sincere and serious conversation with your physician, which route you would have to go from this point on. And there are two possible options. One option is you still say, well, I'm still healthy, I'm still young, and I'm still able to tolerate a lot of side effects, and your physician agrees with you. Then you might choose, again, the curative approach. You still try to cure the disease after it failed autologous transplant. And this is the approach that we call allogeneic stem cell transplant. It is very similar to what I described with autologous transplant, but the stem cells are collected from another person. And the idea of this transplant is such that the new stem cells, the new immune system that comes from the donor, that could be either your sibling, brother or sister, or unrelated person, or nowadays we have a special transplant that we can collect stem cells from either parents or kids, and we infuse those cells, and those cells recognize your tumor as the foreign, as, quote, infection, and they attack it. It is called graft versus tumor effect. And it doesn't matter that your lymphoma is resistant to chemotherapy because now it is immune system killing off your tumor. Now, one might say, why don't we do it all the time? The problem with that is that the allogeneic stem cell transplant, when I talk to my patients, the philosophy or paradigm is the same. I use an example of open heart surgery. When the surgeon sits down with you and your family and say, well, we can do the open heart surgery, but it is very, very risky. The same thing with allogeneic transplant. The side effects, the toxicity, and long-term side effects of allogeneic transplant are very, very serious. So much so that a lot of patients can die from procedure itself, and even after the transplant, lymphoma can still come back. And for patients who we manage to cure the lymphoma, majority of them will still have long-term problems, specifically something we call graft versus host disease that can affect any organ, in fact, intestinal tract or liver or mouth. And when we decide to commit to this route, to still curative approach, try to cure the disease, we have to understand this is very risky and very toxic treatment, and for many patients it will be a trade-off between their lymphoma that might be cured, but life with potentially significant side effects impacting quality of life. Now, the second option after relapse post-autologous transplant is what we term in oncology a palliative approach. And a palliative approach is the route where either the patient is not fit enough or does not want to go through all the risks of a transplant, or physician feels it's not the option, or we cannot identify the suitable donor. And we try to treat patients with less chemotherapy, potentially or most frequently one or two drugs at a time, or experimental therapy that will control the disease, but at the same time will not have many side effects. So we try to prolong the person's life, but make it a quality life. So people do not have to go to the hospital, they don't have to be hospitalized for chemotherapy or subsequent infections. And the fine line we walk in is between efficacy of drugs we use and the quality of life. And in this situation, there are several possible options. And I will jump right in and introduce you with a very exciting new development in Hodgkin lymphoma, because I think at this point in time, it sort of trumps all the other options we used to use in this situation. Recently, we were one of the centers participating in a clinical trial of the drug called SGN-35. Or later on, it was termed by the company Adcetris. It's a brand name that I don't like to use. But SGN-35 is a biologic conjugate with chemotherapy that delivers chemotherapy specifically to tumor cells and avoids systemic effect on organs and systems and allows for a lot of chemo drug to concentrate in a tumor. And when we tested this drug in the patients whose disease came back after autologous transplant, significant proportion, majority of patients responded to treatment. And in those who responded, the duration, how long the response lasted, was very, very long. So it became a very exciting and very tolerable salvage option or palliative option for patients who are not eligible or do not want to go to allogeneic transplant. Outside SGN-35, the traditionally used agents that have significant activity in Hodgkin lymphoma include gemcitabine or GemZAR, either as a single agent or in combination with another drug. I would tell you at this point, though, then when you talk to your physician, and if in the palliative setting you sense that you're offered 3-4 drugs at a time, I personally think it's a wrong choice, because the toxicity then should be significantly higher than the effect that you're getting. So majority of physicians in academia and those who treat Hodgkin lymphoma would suggest that you use 1 or 2 drugs at a time. So gemcitabine or GemZAR is a very active drug, and we are receiving signal now from early clinical trials that another exciting agent called bendamustine also has significant activity in this disease. And the trials are rapidly now moving on to prove that and give another option for patients with a relapsed Hodgkin lymphoma who need that palliative treatment. Finally, I will mention that participation in clinical trials is very, very important at any stage of Hodgkin lymphoma, because despite the fact that majority of patients will get cured, we try to bring this number up and up and up. In addition, we try to reduce the toxicity of our therapies, maintaining the same success rate. So before we claim complete victory over Hodgkin lymphoma, we still have work to do. And for patients, they have potential benefit of receiving therapy that is not standard of care yet, but will become in the future, will be a better treatment long before it's actually materialized. Those of you who go to autologous transplant, I will just mention one very exciting trial that utilizing the drug I just mentioned, SGN-35, those of you who have relapsed disease, go to autologous transplant and have high-risk disease, your physician can explain to you, then the trial is given SGN-35 after the transplant. And I think that we probably will see significant improvement in outcomes after transplant that will be very, very important for relapsed disease patients. But until we do the study, we are not going to know this. So I will finish here, and I will take any questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Shispa, for a wonderful presentation, very informative, and I know there will be questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you so much. Our next speaker is Izumi Nakano. Izumi is Patient Services Manager for the Lymphoma Research Foundation, and she is going to address the free support services and programs offered by the Lymphoma Research Foundation. Izumi?
Thank you, Carolyn and Cancer Care, for the partnership and collaboration on this call. The Lymphoma Research Foundation and Cancer Care have partnered on our teleconference programs for years to better meet the needs of people affected by lymphoma. Thank you to our esteemed faculty, Dr. Schustoff and Strauss, for your taking the time to be with us today. I would also like to acknowledge Seattle Genetics for supporting this program. The Lymphoma Research Foundation is the nation's largest lymphoma-focused nonprofit organization devoted exclusively to funding lymphoma research and providing the lymphoma community with timely information on this disease. LRF's mission is to eradicate lymphoma and serve those touched by this disease. LRF invests millions of dollars each year to combat lymphoma and assist those whose lives have been affected by a lymphoma diagnosis. The foundation remains dedicated to identifying a cure through an aggressively funded research program and to help members of the lymphoma community by providing comprehensive, disease-specific programs and services. To date, LRF has funded over $47.5 million in lymphoma-specific research. Over 40,000 people are served each year by the LRF programs. LRF provides a comprehensive series of programs and services for people with lymphoma and their loved ones, which include our Lymphoma Helpline, where our professional public health and mental health staff can assist you in your search for information about lymphoma and appropriate resources. We also offer a clinical trials information service, where a member of our helpline team can assist you in your search for clinical trials. The Lymphoma Support Network, which is a national one-to-one peer support program that matches lymphoma patients or caregivers with volunteers who have had similar lymphoma-related experiences, is also a very positive program. We also offer publications and newsletters, which include comprehensive disease guides, disease-specific fact sheets, and informational e-newsletters. We also offer webcasts and podcasts, which are available on specific types of lymphoma, treatment options, and support topics. And finally, in-person patient conferences on the local, regional, and national level. For more information, please contact a member of our helpline team by calling 1-800-500-9976 or visit our website at www.lymphoma.org. Carolyn?
Thank you very much. And I actually want to thank Zumi, and I also want to thank Brian Tomlinson, who actually was really architect for today's program, really helping to choose our speakers and really for the Lymphoma Research Foundation's support for the program today. And so I just want to thank them very much. And I also want to let everyone know this is a wonderful resource for all the participants on the program today. So thank you, Zumi. And our next speaker is Rick Dickens. Rick is an oncology social worker. He's clinical supervisor, blood cancers program coordinator, mind-body project coordinator for cancer care. And Rick is going to review with you the free services that you can access from cancer care. Rick?
Thank you, Carolyn. And I thank you to our esteemed faculty for this very important workshop today. For Hodgkin patients and families, there are numerous issues related to treatment which can impact your quality of life. Many patients experience a watch and wait period, which can create anticipatory anxiety and uncertainty. Concerns about treatment, insurance, jobs, or who will take care of loved ones when you enter treatment are common questions. Changes brought on by treatment can affect sexual and body functions and challenge most people's self-image, eliciting feelings of sadness, anger, fear, and frustration. At the same time, what is happening to the patient can make family and friends feel helpless, scared, and sad as well. The good news is that at some point, the whole cancer process will become more familiar to you, and you will develop what is often called a new normal. Accepting that changes are normal during treatment can go a long way toward nurturing your body, mind, and spirit and help you maintain an enjoyable quality of life. During these times, it is often helpful to seek the help of a social worker or other healthcare professional from organizations such as Cancer Care. At Cancer Care, along with these Connect Education workshops, we offer financial assistance toward transportation to treatment, as well as information about other organizations and resources. We provide counseling by oncology social workers, regional face-to-face groups, and national telephone and online support groups for patients and those who care about them. We also run groups for those patients in their 20s and 30s to address the issues unique to this age population. Most important, at Cancer Care, we provide the opportunity to speak with an oncology social worker who can help you identify people and resources in your community to address your needs as they arise. Cancer Care has been around for over 60 years. All our services are free. To many, support groups, social networks, and information to address practical and emotional issues go a long way in helping to confront the difficult challenge of cancer. Daunting as they are, with help, they are never impossible. You can visit our website at www.cancercare.org, or if you have questions, concerns, or want to speak to a social worker, you can call us at 1-800-813-HOPE, which is 4673, or email us at info@cancercare.org, and a social worker will get back to you to explore how we might help. I wish you all the best.
Thank you very much, Rick. A wonderful presentation, and thank you for also identifying all the different services that are accessible. And now we have time for questions. We have lots of time for questions. I'm going to ask Mary to bring all of our speakers on board and to address the questions. And would you explain to the audience how to queue up for questions? And we'll try to take as many of your questions as possible. Mary?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Our first question comes from Tanya P.
Hi.
Hi, Tanya. Your question?
Yes, I was listening to some of what the first doctor, I'm sorry, I don't remember his name, was saying.
Dr. Strauss, yes.
Yes, different treatments. And I was diagnosed with Hodgkin's lymphoma stage 1A, and I didn't hear the doctor mention anything about doing two cycles of ABVD and then doing radiation therapy. Is that also common?
Okay, well, thank you for your question, Tanya. I'm going to ask Dr. Strauss to address your question in a general way, and then, of course, we'll want you to go back to your treating healthcare team with, of course, the specifics to you, because, of course, each one of you, of course, has very unique situations. So I'm going to ask Dr. Strauss to just address this in a general way. Dr. Strauss?
Yes, that is a standard treatment established in a clinical trial, a very large clinical trial conducted in Europe. With stage 1 disease, I don't know the details, but the results are very good with a number of different treatment options, but certainly two cycles of ABVD and an involved field radiation therapy, even to a slightly reduced dose of radiation therapy, is a standard treatment, certainly a very standard and acceptable treatment.
Awesome. Thank you. Our next question?
Our next question comes from Bernard K.
Hi. I'm interested in treatment for stage 4 non-Hodgkin's lymphoma.
And did you have a specific question?
Yeah, what is the standard treatment for that? It's B, type B, stage 4 non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. Actually, I have two questions, and the other one is, if you ask for a second opinion from another doctor, does that take away your right to remain with your first doctor?
Okay.
Do you jeopardize your
relationship? Okay. Okay, excellent question. Okay. Why don't we take the second question first, and I'm going to ask Dr. Strauss and Dr. Shestov to both weigh in on that, because I think that's a question that many people worry about in terms of seeking a second opinion in general about their disease. Dr. Shestov, do you want to go first?
Yes, absolutely. I think it is very important to understand your rights and actually not necessarily the rights, but your options when you first see your oncologist. In general, it is beneficial every time to seek second opinion in academic centers, not necessarily to go for treatment to academic centers, but have your physician receive up-to-date, state-of-the-art information about any changes that might have happened in management of your disease. Now, for many patients, it is not necessarily possible. They live far away from academic centers, but for those of you who can reach and want to have an opinion of not necessarily a smarter physician, but a physician who is involved in moving the field forward, it is always beneficial. At the same time, 99% of the time, treating physicians in the community always appreciate academicians' input into the care of the patients, if patients can make it. In fact, many of them will recommend second opinion and will always appreciate it. And there is no way that your second opinion trip would change your relationship with your primary oncologist. If this is in fact the case, that I think you need to choose another oncologist, because we all work as a team, as a family, try to provide best care for you and support your family for every patient. So asking another opinion is by no way should be a factor of your anxiety or your primary physician to feel inadequate to treat your disease. So it is encouraged in some situations if your physician feels confident and he attends all the national meetings and keeps up to date, it is not a must. But there is no way you should have any anxiety seeking second opinion.
Thank you. And Dr. Strauss, did you want to add anything to that?
No, I really have nothing to add. I mean, the first part of her question is really a little bit beyond the topic for today. I mean, there are 62 or so different non-Hodgkin lymphomas, and the treatment approaches are quite various. So I think maybe something for another day.
And we have done programs on non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, so I want to thank, actually, Tanya, for asking the question. And, actually, why don't you and I talk after the call? But could you actually say a word, either Dr. Strauss or Dr. Shostov, just about non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, just so that in case there are other people who are struggling with the difference. A lot of people kind of have a hard time with the differences of the names of the diseases.
Well, I could just say in general that we have excellent results in many, many of the patients with the various types of non-Hodgkin lymphomas with current treatments. I will say that a major thing that has really helped is the addition of antibody treatment with a drug called rituximab to chemotherapy, and really in the many of the more common non-Hodgkin lymphomas, this has really improved results. So there is hope for cure and or at least for an excellent outcome for many of the non-Hodgkin lymphomas also.
Excellent. Thank you. And Dr. Shostov, did you want to add to that?
Yes, I will join this, and I would also say that it is very difficult, if not impossible, to answer this question quickly because, as Dr. Strauss have pointed out, there are so many types of non-Hodgkin lymphoma, and the recent developments identified best treatments for subtypes of the disease. So some of them will have very good results with treatment like CHOP. Some of them will have good results with a different treatment. But I would have to say for any subtype, the biggest question, and your oncologist usually is very good addressing this, whether it's so-called indolent lymphoma or aggressive lymphoma, because the paradigm of treatment is completely different, and treatments are completely different. In fact, for indolent lymphomas, we most of the time don't even treat the disease when we diagnose it unless it's really symptomatic and bothering patients. So it's not the simple question to answer unless we have information about it, but I think you're right, that would be a little bit out of scope of Hodgkin lymphoma talk.
Excellent. Well, thank you, Tanya, and I hope you'll take that information back to your treating healthcare team. And I do have another question that actually one of our online participants has sent us, and that is, how does one decide to enter a clinical trial? We've heard about clinical trials, and the question is really, what should go into that decision-making? I'm going to ask Dr. Shostov to go first with that, if you would.
Sure. Participation in clinical trials is a very important topic that I discuss with patients when they come for either treatment or a second opinion consultation to our center. Clinical trials are always challenging for patients. They are daunting, and there is always the factor of unknown. So there are positive features of a clinical trial in terms of enrollment, and there are some unknown, you can call them risk factors. The positive factor is the knowledge that on the clinical trial, even if you have newly diagnosed disease, even if you have disease that have certain track record of cure with current therapies, you have a chance of receiving state-of-the-art treatment that is not approved yet but might prove itself to be even better in the near future. But until this trial is completed and this is proven, it's not available for patients. The risk of that is that, obviously, since it's a clinical trial, we don't know, and you might go through clinical trial and not get any benefit. There are very few trials that are designed that would have additional risks in this situation because we rigorously screen all the side effects and toxicities. And I have to say that the reason we cure so many patients with Hodgkin lymphoma nowadays, it is the participation in the clinical trials. I would also make an example of pediatric oncology, where 90% of children who have cancer are treated on clinical trials, and pediatricians are doing way, way better than adult oncologists in curing pediatric cancer. And one of the factors we are struggling, as myself and Dr. Strauss working in academic institutions, we don't have this participation for adults. And I think a lot of adults are missing out on opportunity of getting more advanced treatments. But again, there is a factor of unknown. A lot of patients don't have means to travel to academic centers. So you have to weigh all these factors, whether you're willing to take the risk and take the treatment that is not proven yet under very strict supervision and follow-up of physicians who are doing trials, or you're satisfied with what the standard treatment is at this point in time. And again, this is best addressed probably by second opinion consultations when you go to academic centers. But I would certainly encourage everyone who is listening, patients and their families, to at least consider this option and take your time thinking about this, because that's how we move the field forward, and that's how patients potentially can receive better treatments in real time instead of waiting for results of the studies that sometimes take 5-10 years to really prove that they are better than what we have right now.
Excellent. Thank you. And thank you so much, Dr. Shostov. And Dr. Strauss, did you want to add?
I would just add a couple of things. One is that clinical trials are really done usually in the context of trying to improve on what's out there. So most clinical trials, particularly for clinical trials for first treatment, are trials where we think that the treatment will be at least as good as standard treatment, and possibly better. We don't know the answer of the clinic. If we knew the answer to that question, we wouldn't do the clinical trial. I mean, there's some risk that you could not do well on the clinical trial, but usually it's in the context of trying to do something that would be at least as good as what as more standard options. And I think a second thing that I'd like to add is I think a quality added for clinical trials is that they are, as Dr. Shostov said, very carefully supervised. So they often are done according to what's called a protocol, where everything is followed formally. There's a formal plan for very, very careful follow-up. And I think that adds a certain quality, a formal quality control for treatment. Not to say that we aren't careful in patients that we treat off clinical trials, but I think being on a clinical trial has that added value of quality control.
Excellent. Thank you. And Mary, our next question, please.
Our next question comes from Ilka W.
Speakers had commented about using SGN35 after autologous transplantation. I'm wondering if there's anything being done using SGN35 either after relapse or in conjunction with before going through the autologous transplant to get you into complete remission.
Thank you for that question. Dr. Shostov, could you address that?
Yes, sure. So they mentioned SGN35 agent, as I described very briefly due to time constraints, is probably one of the most exciting new drugs that we have discovered and tested in Hodgkin lymphoma. And so far, it has been not extensively but properly tested in a scenario where patients receive autologous transplant in the schema that I described, and then disease unfortunately comes back. And those patients went into initial study of SGN35, and it turned out that it was so effective that majority of patients responded to treatment and were able to either continue on treatment or go on to the next step, allogeneic transplant that I mentioned. Now, based on the results of this, the only situation that SGN35 has been approved for use in the United States was in this scenario, post-transplant relapse, but also if patients received at least two lines of or two different types of combination chemotherapy and had no response to treatment. So your physicians are free to use SGN35 on label, so insurances don't have any issues with that, and it's a proper use of the drug. Now, in the setting of clinical trials, There are several studies that are ongoing in the United States. One that I mentioned is post-transplant, but your question relates really pre-transplant. So there are several studies that are combining now SGN35 with ABVD treatment. These are not readily accessible studies. You would have to go into the national study website and see which centers participate in this. But the answer is yes, we are trying to add SGN35 to even frontline treatment, but until those studies are completed, we won't know whether it's of any benefit. In addition, there are small studies in some academic centers that combining SGN35 as a second step if your lymphoma relapsed after ABVD treatment, whether it is in conjunction with ICE chemotherapy or this bendamustine-containing chemotherapy, but those are specific studies that are only accessible in certain institutions. We are trying to move this agent up now into the initial treatment, second-line treatment, or second time when patients are treated after relapse, but outside clinical trials, it is not available for this indication. And the proper, again, use of this drug would be post-transplant or if your disease did not relapse, or your disease relapsed after two different chemotherapy regimens. As far as the clinical study, I think it's very important to be aware if your disease came back after transplant that there is a study where SGN35 is used to reduce the chance it will come back.
Excellent. Thank you. Our next question, Mary.
Our next question comes from Mala R.
Yes, please. This is for Dr. Shustov. You mentioned about the SGN35 trials. Can you tell me what kind of trials are available in the Atlanta or Southeast region?
I thought just Shustov to address your question in a general way, and then we...
Yeah, it's off top of my head. Again, the studies that are not national or are not activated at our center, I have limited immediate knowledge which center is activating which trial. And the reason for that is the way studies are done in the United States. Once the national studies are addressed, then every center is free to open or they can receive funding for their own studies, small studies. And I don't have information about national registry, but you can obtain this through the National Cancer Institute, NCI, website because all of these trials are registered with National Institute of Health or National Cancer Institute. So if you log into the website. In addition, I think a lot of the studies could be mentioned in the Lymphoma Research Foundation website. So there are online resources that you can locate studies in a particular region of the United States.
That's an excellent recommendation. Both of those sites, the www.cancer.gov or actually the Lymphoma Research Foundation, either call them or actually their website would give you that information as well. I want to thank our speakers today. You've been an extraordinary speakers, just wonderful. And I have to say also all of you have queued up and asked such really wonderful questions. You've been a terrific audience, I have to say. It's a great call. And I also want to thank all of you who've been listening. I do want to remind you that this is a one-hour program and that when we plan a workshop like this, we do recognize that you all have many needs that go far beyond the scope of a one-hour program. So with that in mind, I do want to remind all of you that if you didn't get to ask a question or if you have a concern or something that you're struggling with, there are two organizations that have really worked together, collaborated to make this program possible, and our staff are standing by to answer your questions or be available to you. So one is the Lymphoma Research Foundation, and actually their toll-free number is 1-800-500-9976 or www.lymphoma.org. So you certainly can contact them. And the other organization for psychosocial concerns is Cancer Care, and that number is 1-800-813-HOPE. Or you can call us or visit our website at www.cancercare.org. Most importantly, as we conclude the program today, we don't want anyone to feel that you're alone in coping with Hodgkin's lymphoma in coping with cancer. We want you to now know that you're part of a community of support and that there are lots of resources out there that offer free service to each of you in terms of your coping and questions that you may have. So please take advantage of these services. Also, we are approaching a holiday season in the United States, and many people also have many issues and questions that come up during this time. Please take advantage of these organizations and all the others that are collaborating as well so that you can get the support and help you need to really cope in the best way possible. So I want to thank you all for participating today, And I wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may disconnect and have a wonderful day.